Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And
today's program. Good morning, listeners. I just wanted to let you know I'm here too.
Yeah, Peter's here.
he's here with his finger on the recorder.
Yes. And today's program, as I started to say, is really about culinary education in a number of different ways, starting with the grand dame of cooking schools, La Varenne.
Yeah, there you go. Now it's just a fascinating story.
Ann Willen is always welcome on the show.
Yeah, and we'll say it right here, even though we said it in the interview as well. We're still totally amazed that this English woman decided that she would not only take on founding a cooking school in France, but she'd also teach it in English and French together. Anyway,
here's Ann Willen.
Certainly the grand dame.
Ann Willen. Always, always, always we love talking to you. And congratulations on the release of Secrets from the La Varenne Kitchen.
Well, it's always a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, as I said to you before when we were chatting, when I read all of these testimonials from alumnus from the school, it's a good thing that you released this book because everybody says that their copy, the document that you gave them as they went into class at your Parisian cooking school, the copies were stained and they were tattered and they were worn out. So I guess they'll all be rushing out to get new ones.
Well, that would be lovely. It was our very first book and it was indispensable, which is why they're all tattered and stained.
Uh-huh.
When we first started, of course, classic cooking, it has kind of structured so that there are basic recipes that you need all the time, like the proportions of pie pastry or meringue, and even ice cream, and you need the background recipe to look it up. And we were handing out so many, in those days, Ronio'd, it's as long ago as that, sheets of paper.
Oh,
necessity. We printed a little booklet called The La Varenne Basic Book, and it never went into actual published print. This is the first time. So everybody's had to keep their little booklet.
Well, you have a subtitle here of 50 Essential Recipes Every Cook Needs to Know. And I think it's we should point out that these are not really finished recipes in the sense of specific dishes, but they're really the essential building blocks to make all those other dishes.
Exactly.
Run through just some of the ground you cover here. Stock.
Indeed. We start with stock, and we called the school La Varenne after a chef who wrote the first classic French cookbook in 1651.
Wow.
And he's with fond, which means stock. Isn't that lovely?
Yes, it is. And you do sauces. You're very particular, and I trust these recipes because they've been tested over and over and over again, have they not?
They indeed have. And there was nothing that I needed to change in the original text. We didn't even change any of the wording.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, you rerun the original introduction, actually, that you had for the original book. Was it 1975?
Indeed, it was. Actually, I think it was 1976.
76.
But yes, it was right at the beginning of the school. And what I said then, in fact, is just as valid now. You need to start with the basic.
Now, I seem to remember reading the background about the book, that there was a French chef, a well-respected French chef, who said that this book contained all the recipes you needed.
That was our wonderful pastry chef, Albert Joron. And, of course, pastry particularly is built up from all these building blocks. And so the book has things like puff pastry, but genoise and biscuit and buttercream. And with those components, just like Chef Joron said, you can put together everything, as far as he was concerned.
Okay, now I get, now I understand. I understand what he said better, having looked at the book, mm-hmm. and realizing, I guess, that he was referencing his domain of pastry.
Exactly, but it's true in a less obvious sense for cuisine as well, because the brown sauces, the mayonnaise, nowadays mayonnaise is often hyped up with garlic and with chili pepper and with sometimes with Asian even ingredients, so, but you always start with the basic recipe.
Funny you should mention that, because in my refrigerator right now, the only mayonnaise that's in there is Japanese spicy mayonnaise.
There you go.
Because we would use a jar of conventional mayonnaise. We would use one at least every 5 years. I want to point something out, because devotees of your book will be in for a surprise unless they hear this, or unless they're particularly observant, because The Art of French Cooking is a very large book. It contains an enormous amount of wisdom, incidentally. It includes the tongue recipe, which I use all the time whenever I can lay my hands on tongue. But this book is very small.
About the country cooking of
country,
France.
Country cooking of France.
Yeah, that's your book. And
that's
country,
my book.
The Peter swears by your tongue recipe.
But those are the finished recipes.
Right.
And actually, almost all big books have a glossary at the back, which we'll have most of the recipes, possibly not all, that are in the Secrets of the Lover and Kitchen. So it's things that are used more than once in the main book, like pie pastry or white butter sauce or basic egg custard that you put in mousses or creme caramel, that kind of thing.
Traditional as this, and as basic as this book is and your essentials, you come across things that I've really, frankly, even after all these years, I had no idea that you could store fondant in a tight container for a year. I just was flabbergasted.
But it's true, because all it is sugar.
I never thought of it that way.
That would be really handy for us, except we'd want it to last about 10 years.
Well, yes. Fondant has disappeared for the moment, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I was joking about ourselves, because I think we must have bought sugar once upon a time about 30 years ago. And we still have some of the same package left.
Well, good for you.
Well, we don't.
we don't eat it very much.
We don't have a sweet tooth, is the problem. Now, tell me about biscuit. Now, Peter said that, of course, in England, as you would know, that biscuit was cookie, was really cooked twice. Now, is that the translation? How did we get to the word biscuit?
You know, I'm really not very sure. Because it too in French, of course, means twice cooked.
Well, that's what we're talking about, right?
Yes. And biscuit, well, it came from kind of southeastern France, from Savoy. Or it's associated with Savoy. And biscuit is slightly drier than Genoise, because the eggs are separated.
Right.
And you whisk the egg yolks with sugar and the egg whites with sugar, and then you mix them together and mix in the flour. And when baked, you get a slightly drier and, I guess, faintly biscuit crust on the outside. But that's just me fantasizing slightly.
So they're really not cooked twice.
No, they're not cooked twice.
So it's one of those fake words.
It's a fake word, but it's a word that goes way back.
Yes.
Yes, somebody made it up a very long time ago and kept their little secret, right?
Yes. Indeed, it could be, because it'll hold up better. It gets rather dry, but you can soak it in nice alcohol or fruit juice. So perhaps they pastry chefs in the old days felt that it would hold up better than Genoise.
I have two questions, kind of tangentially relate, but when you look through the roster of all of these people, these great chefs and cooks who have passed through La Varenne, are you not totally amazed by all this talent? I mean, you are an icon in the whole field of cooking, and you've certainly got plenty of recognition from everybody, and your PBS series got recognition, but all the greats went to your school. Did you ever envision having this kind of a legacy is the one question. And the second question is the one that Peter asks me every time we talk to you or we're about to talk to you, is whatever gave you the nerve to start a cooking school in Paris?
Well, indeed, I'm enormously proud to see where the many, many places that our students have gone and how successful many of them are. I've kept up with a good many of them, and it's sort of an extended family and a great pleasure. I've never really thought, I didn't have that aspect in mind when I created the school. What I had in mind was my own training, and I started teaching at the London Cordon Bleu, taught there for a couple of years, and then moved to the Cordon Bleu in Paris, where I found a whole new world, of course, in France, of classic cooking and regional cooking and historical cooking and pastries and confiserie and all of the kind of intellectual structure which has always intrigued me, as well as the practical side of cooking. And I was determined that I wanted to make it easy for people like me, that's to say foreigners, for women.
And you were the first one to do it in bilingually, French and English.
Exactly. I was the first one to supply written recipes, hence the basic book, uh-huh, now become Secret of the from the La Varenne Kitchen. And I had, looking back on it, I guess, I was crazy.
I figured that was the answer to Peter's question.
And the French came round and sort of, well, first of all, when they heard a foreigner opening a French cooking school in France, they kind of sniffed.
And a woman.
And a woman.
And an English woman, to make it worse.
English woman. Yes, a foreign woman. But then we started asking some of the young chefs, and this was the time when Nouvelle Cuisine was just beginning, or just expanding, and to come and teach, give a demonstration in the afternoons. And they first of all kind of sniffed and said, oh, all these foreigners and a woman. But then when they came, they found somewhere that they recognized, somewhere that we were really immersed in cooking, that we were really enthusiastic about it. And hopefully, I think they found something that we were communicating to enthusiastic would-be cooks. And most cooks who are really devoted to what they're doing want to pass on what they know. And so that's really what we focus on.
Yeah, you have this built-in pride and urge to teach, anyhow, you personally.
Yes, I do. But I think I'm not uncommon among people who love cooking.
You know, I mean, we could go through a list of all these great chefs that have come through La Varenne. Alex Warnes Kelly, Steve Racklin, Amanda Hesser, Gail Grant. It goes on and on and on. But something sticks in my mind that there was one student that was rejected. His application was rejected because he was not experienced enough. And I was racking my brain to think who it was. Could that have been Nathan Myhrvold?
Oh, yes, it was.
I thought so.
You are absolutely right. That was a long way down the road from 1975.
Right.
And that was in the early 2000s. And Nathan got in touch with one of our graduates, who's a very successful food writer and cook in Seattle called Cynthia Nim and said, I want to go to La Varenne. And she said, well, I'll get in touch with Anne. And she said, he's a businessman with one of these new startup internet companies. Perhaps it was the 90s, called Microsoft. And I said, look, we really don't want amateur business coming on the professional course. They'll only disrupt everybody else because they won't know anything, and they're not looking for what we're offering. And she said, well, he won't like that answer. And he's the kind of person who doesn't like no for an answer. What would he have to do? And I said, well, he would have to cook with a French cook for at least 3 months before we would accept. And I thought, that's bound to put him off. Great. And I didn't really think twice about it. And Lomi Mason went to, now it's Thierry, and I can't remember his other name. Anyway, the top chef in Seattle.
Thierry, yes, Retro.
Thierry Retro.
Exactly. Yeah. And every Friday and Saturday night, Mason cooked with Thierry. And after 6 months, actually, I think after a year, he came back and he said, now will you let me into La Varenne? So we said yes.
Was he a pretty decent cook?
He was a decent cook. And, of course, he is a very, very good cook. He's a fascinating cook. I was invited to the most amazing dinner that he gave to women in food. Oh, it was in sort of May last year, I think, where he and his team in his kitchen cooked 35 modernist cuisine dishes. So we tasted 35 courses.
Wow.
And they were absolutely amazing. He understands what he has, the instinct for ingredients. He has a very Ferran Adria quirky sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he uses all kinds of way-out techniques that one sort of never had before.
Well, what an experience for you. Yes. Anne, you're always doing something new and different. And I wish you luck with this book, Secrets from La Varenne Kitchen, from the La Varenne Kitchen. I think you'll have a whole new coterie of followers as a result of spreading the word about these basic recipes. Thank you for talking to us.
It's always just a pleasure.
And with us, too.
And let's sneak in, before we say goodbye, let's sneak in a Rule Britannia.
Raise the flag.
Raise the flag. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back. Here we are again. And speaking of bilingual culinary education, you can listen next to this delightful Claudine Pepin, who has a book called Kids Cook French, taking it to the children's level and also doing it in two languages, English and French.
And in collaboration with our well-known father, Jacques Pepin.
The illustrations are wonderful.
Who turns illustrator rather than chef. And I thought it was really funny, the remark in the middle of the interview where she said Jacques actually sold some of his work, which he was really amazed about because he never tried, but he decided to sell it when somebody decided they wanted to buy it from him.
Claudine Pepin, you are surrounded in your life by chefs, aren't you?
I absolutely am, and I'm delighted to be speaking with you today.
Well, that's great. And we love your book, Kids Cook French. Should I try it? Les enfants cuisinent à la française.
Yeah, and it's funny, les enfants cuisinent. à la française.
Cuisine à la française.
Yep, and it's not cuisine. That's what it looks like. But remember, in France, we use lots of letters. We just don't pronounce all of them.
Yeah, oh, it's always a good one. I think. But the thing about this is, not the only reason I attempted my really horrible French was because it's an interesting concept. It's a cookbook for kids about how to cook French dishes, and yet it's in bilingual, in English and in French, so that it serves many different purposes.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the purposes in doing this book, these are truly wonderful family favorites. I don't think that I am going to take the culinary world by storm with this little book. I mean, you want to make a cheese fondue, I'm sure you can find 700 different recipes, many of which are better than mine. Not all of them, but many, I'm sure.
I'm going to go look for I'm giving this cookbook to our grandchildren, and I'm going to go look for our fondue pot that we got as a wedding present.
Exactly, right? You finally have an excuse to take out the fondue pot. But for me, having the translation, and it is a beautiful, beautiful translation in real French, allows it to go in a different direction. So if you're a French teacher and you want to inspire kids to learn the language with some soul and with some heart, then you can have them cook in French as opposed to only in English.
Right.
And so I think it's really nice that way.
I feel like I know you because I first encountered you when you were doing the television series with your father, the sublime Jacques Pepin. And how long, they're still rerunning those, aren't they?
They are. We're coming out with our last series with KQED that will begin airing in the fall. It is called Heart and Soul.
Oh, great.
And we're very, very excited. And the last series prior to that, Essential Pépin, had my daughter, Shori. And in this series, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen, my daughter will also be on there. So you've got three generations of eaters.
Right,
your
husband is also a chef. He's a chef instructor at Johnston & Wales.
Yes, he is. And he was in restaurants for 20 years prior to that.
Uh-huh.
And now he's an academic, which is strange for the wife of a chef to actually have a husband that's home sometimes.
Well, yeah, there's a woman, actually, I won't say who her husband is, but she tweets under the chef's widow.
Right, and I was perfectly okay with being a chef's widow. I knew exactly what it meant. I grew up that way, so it was fine. And honestly, we never really thought that it was a bad thing or a good thing. It's just an is thing, and this is how you grow up. This is what you do, and it's all perfectly fine. But now he's home,
mm-hmm.
and he's home on weekends.
Oh, that's
and
really...
then he's home for Christmas and New Year's. It's really quite remarkable.
Now, this is a delightful book. It's hardcover. It looks like it will hold up for actually using it to cook in the kitchen. But, boy, you don't want to spoil these delightful illustrations, mainly by your father, Jacques, but also including your daughter.
Yes. Yes, sure. I did several of the illustrations. Some of them they cut apart. Like the little hearts and stuff, they've scattered through. On if you actually have the book in front of you, if you look at page 61, there's a knife there. Shori drew that.
61, I'm looking.
And I think she did a very, very good job. I did put a knife out in front of her, so she had a model.
That's all right. It's very good.
I think so, right? She did a really good job.
And she's 11.
Yes.
Right.
Well, she'll be 11 in March.
Okay.
She's still 10.
Now, I'm not sure about the French classic French dishes. The whole thing is you have to view it as a family package because there's so much family involved with this book. But what particular age group are you targeting?
I do see what you mean. I mean, I don't think a 3-year-old is going to be able to pick up the book and cook out of it. But I think that anybody who wants to spend time with their family and friends in the kitchen and is a bit of a Francophile is going to enjoy this book.
Right.
It's not, I wouldn't say it's geared towards age 10. It's not. There are recipes in there that you definitely need to be somewhat competent in the kitchen and other recipes where you don't need to be nearly as competent in the kitchen.
And what would an 8-year-old be able to tackle?
Well, I think an 8-year-old would be able to do cheese fondue. It depends. Does the 8-year-old know how to use a knife? And if they do, and lots of 8-year-olds do, I can do cheese fondue. They can definitely do the deviled eggs, the œuf Jeannette. The cauliflower souffle is a lot easier than most people think. They can make a croque-monsieur.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right, you know,
yeah.
And a lot of
string
it,
beans. that's good.
Yeah, I mean,
we have our granddaughter is intrigued with languages, and I taught her early on, probably 3 years ago, to say turquoise. So she loves being able to say turquoise.
Nice.
Now, a standout, as far as I'm concerned, your dad's chickens. I mentioned that to you before. They have so much personality.
Oh, the drawings. I thought you meant the roasted.
Oh, no. I'm talking about the drawings. I just love them.
Oh, yeah. No, they're happy little chickens. They definitely do have a lot of personality.
Well, has he always had this talent for drawing?
When he was at Columbia University, he took several art classes, and it's just something that he really, really enjoys doing. Sold some of his art only because somebody offered to buy it. I don't think it ever occurred to him to do it. And he sold some pieces, which is really fun, and I know it's very gratifying for him. And it's just been, it's a hobby of his, and it's great. For Christmas this year, I got him a really cool portable art set that they have since taken on vacation.
Oh, great.
And he has a lot of fun. And he does a lot of drawing with Shori and stuff, which is really great as well.
Let's talk about some of the recipes. What do you think is most characteristic of these recipes that you grew up with? And you start with a classical recipe, but then you make it your own. Is there a recipe that's illustrative of this approach?
Well, I think probably the cauliflower souffle.
Uh-huh.
So a traditional souffle, what people do is they separate the eggs, and then you fold in the whites, you get a fluffier souffle. This recipe started with my grandmother on my father's side getting married and knowing that her new husband liked cheese souffle. Had no idea how to make it, and she just mixed the eggs with the cheese and the bechamel, and she put it in the oven, and it did rise.
It was very, very
good.
I may have to try that because I can't believe it would rise.
It does. It really does. It works really nicely. It doesn't rise nearly as much as if you separate the two, but trust me, it's very, very good. And so that's a recipe that I grew up with. And then one day I thought, oh, I bet this would be good with vegetables in it. What would I do? How would I do that? And I cooked cauliflower until it was seriously cooked, like potatoes for mashed potatoes. I mashed it up, I dried it out, and I incorporated it into the souffle. And it works beautifully. And I've since done it with zucchini. You can do it with just about any vegetable that you can mash into a puree.
Oh, that's great.
So as long as you make sure to get all of the, as much of the water content as is possible out. And it works great. So that's the evolution of one of the recipes.
And then the story was delightful about your spinach and bechamel.
Yes. Yeah, that was actually pretty funny, doing the House Beautiful article, and I just put the frozen spinach in the bechamel. There you go.
And your father was horrified.
Yeah, he was like, what are you doing? I'm like, obviously I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. But it works very, very well. And, of course, frozen, fresh. You can do it either way.
You start out the book with a note for kids, followed by a note for parents. Just give us a hint at what kinds of things you're telling the kids and the parents.
Well, probably a similar message to both kids and parents is that cooking is fun.
Mm-hmm.
And if you plan your time and you shop for your ingredients and you know you have the time to do this and you work together, that it can be a pleasurable and very gratifying process. And if you make a mistake, so far I have never heard of a culinary prison. And you could come up with a recipe that is completely your own in doing that. And so to never really allow yourself to be intimidated. There's always going to be someone that is snooty and they use bigger words and they think they know more than you. But I think people need to trust their own palate and also understand, especially parents, that if somebody comes up to me and says, well, my kids only eat pizza, macaroni and cheese, and chicken fingers, I actually think that that's absurd, because the three-year-old doesn't have a driver's license and can't go to the store and choose those things, put in their body. If you give a kid real food, they will eat real food. Do we ever eat chicken nuggets? Yes, we do. In fact, Shori, for many, many years, she's older now, but she thought that McDonald's existed only in the airports. Why? Because we had McDonald's at the airport, and I think that's fine. But to also, she also understood that lamb chops are great, because we had lamb chops, to allow their palate to develop. And they'll find things that they don't like, or that they like more, or that they like less, but they don't have a chance if you don't give them real food.
Now, one of the things I thought was especially interesting were the little tips, the little notes that you have appearing to be attached to the pages.
With little hearts.
With Shori's little hearts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's some really good advice contained in these little bon mots, I guess you might call them.
Tips. Oh, good. I'm glad you think so.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of people are doing that with their cookbooks these days. And these helpful hints are sometimes really the best part, because they might even tell you why what you've been doing has been failing all these years, and now you have a better idea.
Right. Yeah, I was just sort of thinking as we were writing the recipes, I was sort of thinking as kind of a side note, or what else is important, whether it's soaking the pots or cleaning up the kitchen or setting the table early and so on, of other things that kind of make the hour that you eat into a real meal. So that's hopefully that it helps a little bit on those fronts.
Now, I didn't quite follow the one about the salted butter, and you said you always use unsalted butter because somehow the salt in the butter might allow you not to sense that the butter wasn't good?
Well, salt is by nature a preservative.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So if you salt fish or salt meat, you make saucisson, or you make whatever, salt is a preservative.
Mm-hmm.
So butter can actually be rancid and still cut fine and still fry fine, but you get that kind of that hint of rancid taste behind the salt.
Okay.
And it really sort of taints the dish.
So your suggestion is use unsalted butter because it'll be much clearer.
It will always be clearer, and you can always add salt. Salt,
yeah,
is, you can never take salt away. And not to say I don't like salt. Goodness, give me a radish and some salt,
oh,
and
good.
I'm very happy.
And butter.
Cultured, yeah,
butter.
So I take the butter, I put it on the radish, I dip the whole thing in salt, and I think it's wonderful. So it's not that I'm shying away from the salt. I just don't think it's necessary in butter.
The thing I didn't understand was, it never occurred to me about the Wondra. You say it's cooked?
Yes. Yes. Wondra is a cooked flour. You find it in the gravy aisle.
No,
or sometimes in the flour aisle, depending.
Yeah, I know it, but I didn't know it was cooked. I know
and
the name.
It's a cooked flour, which is why it doesn't ever get gummy and pasty when you use it to coat fish or chicken or whatever you want to use it to coat. Shrimp is also great. And it's so fine. It's sort of like, almost like baby powder, fine. But it doesn't get gummy, which is why you can take Wondra and pour it into a hot liquid and not end up with dumplings.
Oh, great.
It's a gravy thickener. That's what it is. I just use it for something else.
I've never explored it, so I don't know.
Oh, you should. Grab a little piece of whitefish.
Well, now I know.
Pat it dry. And you don't need eggs and other things and panko and whatever. Honestly, just you sprinkle it onto a plate, put your fish on it, sprinkle it on the top, salt, pepper, up in the pan, and you're good to go. And it just creates this very, very fine crust on it that keeps the moisture in and is wonderful.
Well, the book is filled with little tips like that, but the overall thing, I think, Claudine, is it really does have this spirit of fun with the family cooking and eating together in the kitchen, and there couldn't be a better time for this book to arrive than right now. I know families that don't even sit down to eat.
Yeah, I unfortunately do as well. I don't understand that. Every night, Raleigh is at work. He works until 8, 9 o'clock. Shori and I set the table, and we sit down, and the television is off. The radio is on, because we might sing during dinner, but we sit down, and we eat dinner together, the two of us.
Well, that is something that needs to be preserved because it's disappearing in this current generation, raising kids.
They're the rules around here, by the way.
Oh, yeah, we've always done that.
We sit down for lunch and dinner.
Yeah, well, we...
Lunch, I can say, everybody can be on their own. I'll put out stuff, and we might happen to be sitting together and so on. Lunch, I'm not big on. Breakfast, Shori sits with her father, and dinner, we all sit together.
That's how it is. And that's the way it should be. So, anyhow, well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your book.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And I'm sure it's going to be a big hit. Again, it's called Kids Cook French, Claudine Pepin, and Check Out the Chickens. Thanks,
Thank
Claudine.
You so very much, Anne and Peter. This is really a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And don't go away because we have another segment coming right up.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again. Think of it. Is there one food that's sort of universally appreciated by, adored by kids? It could very well be noodles all over the world. Now, we're going to be talking with Jonathan Sawyer, who actually, I can't even keep track of all his businesses. He has so many businesses going, but his latest venture is actually launching this Noodle Kids Cookbook based on his relations and experiments in the kitchen with his kids and noodles. I have admired you, Jonathan Sawyer, from a distance for years now. and I fully intend that this summer is the summer that I come to your restaurant in Cleveland. You have your flagship is the Greenhouse, right?
Correct. The Greenhouse Tavern is our flagship.
Okay, and then you have some other ventures.
We do. We have a Noodle Cat, which is our ramen shop, and then we have the newest family member, which is Trentina. It's our fine dining homage to the region where my wife's family is from, of Trento, North Italy.
Oh, sure. That's up in the mountains, right?
Yes. Just on the Alpine and Austrian border, a fascinating region that I really love.
We've looked up at it.
Okay.
When we were at Lydia Bastianich's place.
Yeah, we were just falling Friuli.
The mountains in the background.
Oh, yeah.
And their property, the Dolomites.
Friuli, Trieste, Trento, I mean, those are really, I think, the emerging sort of destinations for all European tourism in Italy. And I think now the Americans are starting to pay attention.
Yeah, we've been going to Friuli for a long time.
Yeah, we made our second trip last year.
Yeah.
And we just love it.
We've been to Abruzzo. I went to school in Florence. And we've been to, I guess, Tuscany lots of times, but...
But anyway, the reason we're talking to Jonathan today is a little different than that.
Yeah.
Although it stars a characters we already met virtually, I guess, because we met Noodle Cat.
I love that logo.
And Noodle Cat is really one smart feline.
So anyhow, but this book is called Noodle Kids, and it's subtitled Around the World in 50 Fun, Healthy, creative recipes the whole family can cook together. And your family certainly does, right?
Absolutely. The inspiration for the book is our home kitchen, and not the kitchens of Trentina, Greenhouse Tavern, or Noodle Cat, but being a chef and having a family, probably being a father first and a husband second and then a chef, it's important for us to cook at home together. And I think what we thought about when we were writing the book was we're pretty darn busy. And if we have enough time in our week to cook 9, 10, 11, maybe even 12 meals together, there's no reason for everybody else in America not to be able to get back in that kitchen
exactly.
And start cooking. So we figured, who doesn't love noodles? And we cook tons of noodles with our kids. And that's sort of where the genesis of Noodle Kids, the book, came from.
Now, you introduce your children, and gorgeous, they really are.
They get that from her mother, right?
Anyhow, but you do have attachment for your KitchenAid stand mixer that makes these noodles. Do you need any special equipment for this book?
No, not really. I think the most complicated piece of equipment that we use is a panini press, or as you mentioned, the attachment for the KitchenAid. No restaurant recipes are in here. This is almost, if there's a class below 101 for pasta, this is the class that we're talking about. And when I say pasta, proverbially, as in the world of noodles, from rice noodles to ramen to fideos to soba to traditional Italian noodles.
Well, you have a very broad definition, which even includes couscous.
Yes, yes. So we do take some liberties.
just a few, but Noodle Cat's always there to keep people on track.
Well, at least, I mean, couscous is pasta, even if it's not noodles.
Well,
correct.
Jonathan snuck that in there just a little bit.
Yeah.
and he knows that, too.
If you look really closely at the gnocchi chapter, I even categorize meatballs as a noodle. Because my wife's family's recipe technically has more than 40% of starch in there, or more than 50% starch in their meatballs.
Funny. Now, I mean, you talk about how universal noodles are and what a long history. Does every cuisine have the equivalent of noodles?
Absolutely. I mean, as the Italians are wont to do, they'll take a lot of credit for inventing a lot of noodles, and I love their enthusiasm and fervor for noodles. But if you date back almost five millennia in China, you can see written records there, as well as every other cuisine. The idea of flour being one of the first and most universally cultivated grains, and the simplest sort of preparation before or after bread is a noodle. And whether it's rice or flour, that's arbitrary, but the idea that this quick and easy and sustainable, both in how much nutrition it has and how easy it is to make, is universal.
Yeah, you enter a little bit into the controversy over whether it really was Marco Polo who brought noodles back to Italy and called them spaghetti.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to stay out of that one for my Italian relatives that will be hearing this.
God, I never thought it, but it's in the book.
Yeah.
You wrote it in the book anyway, and you said it's probably not true.
Yeah, I guess the gig's up either way.
Yeah, either way, you're done.
Yeah.
Now, back to this book. We just got another book today of cooking, teaching kids to cook, or a cookbook for kids. It's Cooking French Food, and it's by Jacques Pepin and his daughter.
Oh, Claude, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and what I'm thinking is, I mean, obviously you've noticed too, we years ago when we were at
I'll never forget what's his name.
The Masson. I'm talking about the Children's Cooking School.
Oh, Raymond Blanc.
Raymond Blanc did. It was years ago, actually.
Le Manoir, I can't say
it. Le Manoir, yeah. But it's now everywhere. How do you explain this? You have noticed that there is this very active trend about kids involved in cooking, right?
Absolutely. I think part of the, at least the American half of the reaction to, say, the obesity epidemic of the late 90s, or even if we're still in it, I think we're certainly in the right direction, was to pay attention to children and what they're eating, how they're eating. And then I think if you go even further to the civic responsibility of chefs, we realize that if we are educating kids and giving them tools that they need to make the right decisions for the rest of their life, we are making sure that the world is living on in a more balanced and nutritional way. And I think kids learn so much easier than adults, as we all know. And I think if you start them off early and you engage them in the kitchen, they are way more prone to make those proper decisions than they are if you just tell them to eat their broccoli. I think we all know what happens.
Yeah, but you can
when we
sneak.
Tell kids what
yeah,
to do.
I think we can fast forward on the menu in 2034 or 2036. We can imagine
right.
We can imagine interviewing chefs Lulu and Catcher and saying, now tell us again when you first started cooking. And they said, well, our dad put us in work in the kitchen as soon as we could stand.
So now, what age group, since we're talking about that, what age group is targeted for this book?
Well, I think there is something for all the kids to do. I think you're starting at, really speaking, four on up. But even when Louisiana was three, she knew how to shuck peas. Something as simple and as tactile as that is a great way to start and build confidence. But then when we're talking about four-year-old, five-year-old, six-year-old children, that's when you have the opportunity to start getting them into the kitchen and seeing things that are happening. One of my favorite things with my kids is I taught them how to use a knife by using tofu and a butter knife. And the simplest thing, and something that I think can really build their confidence in the idea of just holding something and cutting something and then eating it.
That's a great suggestion.
But I think the book is, you know, it goes from 4 to 44, depending on your culinary experience.
Now, the funny thing is I never used to cook in my house. My mother was not a very good cook, but I never stepped in to do things for myself. And it turns out now at age 70 plus, I cut my finger about every 5 times I work in the kitchen because I never had that training.
Have you ever tried, you know, I just mentioned in corresponding with you, have you ever tried to teach kids to use chopsticks?
Yeah, I typically teach them how to cheat first, and then once they know how to use a pencil, I think it's easier to explain the chopsticks.
Uh-huh.
So I think it sort of comes with, if you're not born and utilizing that entirely, it comes with cheating and being able to tie a rubber band or a hair band if you have a daughter whose hair is long as Louisiana's with you while you're having ramen around the back end, so it's sort of springy, and then eventually they will watch and want to emulate what their sisters or peers or parents are doing.
You can make a wonderful mess, and it is fun.
But these recipes, these are not kids' recipes. I mean, they're real recipes for real food.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're not making smiley face pizzas and upside down sundaes.
Here's a thought. Can you do what I'm about to, you can easily say no. I thought what fun it would be if you could say, here's a recipe from the book. Now, here's how we dress that up if we were doing it at the greenhouse.
Oh, absolutely.
And here's how we dress it up some more if we were doing it at Trentine. Concept is the same all the way through.
Yeah, from simple to elegant is the approach here. We're getting people used to the nomenclature of making noodles. So once you've mastered our basic pasta dough recipe, which is not one we use at any restaurant, but it's a ratio of 2 cups of flour to 1 egg. Couldn't be simpler if you ever imagine it, 2 to 1. And then you take that recipe and you interpret it through the Greenhouse Tavern's eyes. You're talking about using 2 different flours, AP and semolina, a ratio of egg yolks to whites that's weighed out by gram, and a little bit of water. And then take that exact same recipe once you've mastered it and understand gramming flours and add it into Trentina and the luxurious eye or culinary eye that is Trentina, and you do a tagine pasta dough, which is 100% egg yolks, olive oil, and typically garnished with truffles or a little bit of brown butter and sage. But you can see how the ladder to scale up is just about building confidence on that first level, and then you can have the opportunity to take the next 2 or 3 steps to elevate that recipe.
Now, the things that go along then, could we take a meatball through the same 3 steps?
Yes, meatballs can be, but I think we're talking about varying the breads and the accoutrements and sort of the proteins that go inside of it. There's a meatball we do here in Trentina that's a Trenton meatball. It's called canardelli, and we do it with veal sweetbreads that have a sort of 2 or 3 day process before.
Oh, it sounds fabulous. Sweetbread meatballs.
Yeah.
Bring them on.
Yeah, I love your whole section on ramen. I mean, that's a huge revolution, I think, in the United States, the ramen revolution.
I agree.
Yeah.
I really think that this year is the year that ramen goes out of just the hipster back alleys of certain cities in America and starts to hit the mainstream. And not the mainstream as in college dorms everywhere with salt and hot water.
We all did that.
But on menus like the Greenhouse Tavern.
Now, ramen's making a big noise in London, too.
Oh, we went to a fabulous one of these regional ramen places. I can't even remember. It's a region I never even heard of. Well, but it was a pork ramen that cooked for how many hours?
At least 12.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like a tonkatsu-style ramen.
That's real
milky, rich, heady broth.
Yes, that's what it was.
You got the idea.
Oh, yeah. And that, the noodle recipe for ramen is different, definitely, from China, Japan. You know, the Japanese traditionally only use an alkaline noodle where they have their own proprietary bases that they blend with water and noodles. But the Chinese, because of their history and their propensity for agriculture, they would add actually egg a lot of times to their noodle. And you would have a combo of toothiness from alkaline and egg. So it's really interesting to see the differences now expressed through restaurants as well.
And you know, it's a great way to sneak vegetables into your kids' diet.
Absolutely. Yeah, when we did Noodle Kids, which is an event that we do quarterly at Noodle Cat, the only rule when the kids are building their own ramen is that they have to include 2 vegetables. No other rules. They can put peanut butter and miso in there if they want to, but They have to pick two vegetables.
Well, that's something you do in this book, too. You outline how you go about having one of these ramen parties.
Absolutely.
It sounds like fun. I can hardly wait to try these recipes with my grandkids.
It's a great way to spend a weekend. If it's as cold as it is this winter and you're looking for something engaging to do, or if you want to do the summer rolls. But the idea is that you supply all the mise en place, and then the kids do all the work. And I like the idea of kids building their own bowl of noodles. They will definitely eat what they touch with their own hands.
Well, that's what you say in the book, and I think that that's probably true, too. And you also, just the idea that kids choose what they want to eat, you can't force kids to eat stuff they don't want to eat.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we've learned that throughout the kids as they're growing and they're making their own decisions. If we involve them in the grocery store or in the marketplace or in the kitchen, they're going to eat it when it hits the table.
And, of course, of your various tips that you give, my favorites are, first, make a mess, and secondly, always have fun. And that's what noodle making is about, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's what cooking is all about, is having fun. And the results from being in the kitchen together are so much more than just eating a good plate of food. Conversations that you have with your kids or your grandkids or your neighbor's kids or your cousins over a plate of food that you made together is so much more honest and real than in between the iPad and cable television.
Oh, yes.
Hey, how was school today? And I think that's a really valuable time that we had been missing for a while, and now we're seeing again.
Now, before we close, though, Jonathan, let's put in a plug for those people who are in Cleveland or who happen to travel through Cleveland and don't want to cook noodles but do want to catch up with Chef Jonathan Sawyer. So how do they find out more about your two restaurants? Oh, there are three,
well,
I guess, Noodle Cat, too.
Our restaurant group's website is teamsawyer.org, just like my last name sounds, Sawyer. And our restaurants are downtown in Brown Stadium, in the Cavs Stadium, and in the Cultural District of University Circle. So if you're driving through town or if you are looking for a fun layover in between coasts, I recommend staying in Cleveland and having some ramen or some ravioli or some spetzel with us.
And it's Team, T-E-A-M?
Sawyer.
S-A-W-Y-E-R, spelled just like your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Correct.
however many grands there are in there.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, this book looks like so much fun. I can't wait to test it out on my grandkids. And
well, I really appreciate you guys chatting with me about noodles, and I know you'll have a blast with your grandkids with this book.
Well, they're awesome. I have to tell you that the recipes themselves are delicious. I mean, they really, it's not just playing around. You know, this is not Play-Doh stuff. This is Lulu's, not linguine and clams. This is sauces. I mean, it's so much fun and such delicious stuff.
Do you follow Noodle Cat through the book, too? All of the anecdotes that Miley character takes you through, I think, is sort of the fun for the kids.
Remember to wash
your hands. Here's the anthropology of Fideos. It's really fun to engage that cartoon character that is our Noodle Cat.
So. I like him. It is a he?
I think the Noodle Cat is androgynous, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Jonathan, it's great catching up with you and talking to you, and I hope to do it in person soon.
Such a pleasure. We'll see you in Cleveland soon.
Yes. Bye.
Thank you so much. Ciao.
And that's it for this week's On the Menu radio program. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.